Covered in Glory is presented for the people by Caesars Sportsbook, the greatest sports betting app of all time. Download it, must be 21 years or older. Back to another edition of Covered in Glory presented by Omaha. And Brett, a lot has happened in the little bit of time that has passed since we last spoke. We had two match days. We had all sorts of action up and down the table. And I think the most important headline is the title race is officially on. This is going to be an amazing run-in from now until the end of May. We hope that you will tune in every week for every twist and turn, but we have three worthy contenders, and I think that is what more than anything else I've come to realize, that this is not Manchester City's to lose. It is somebody's to win, because all three of these teams would be actually worthy champions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I didn't think I'd be so invested in a Thursday afternoon Alexis McAllister Thunder Bastard. But yet, here I am. And I didn't even have any money on that game. I just I thought it was exciting. I like this. I mean, it feels like we haven't had a three-way title race like this. And like you said, it's always been seen through the lens of who can beat Manchester City. And now it just seems like it's just a three-way fight. All three wrestlers are in the ring, and there's no favorite. And it's punch for punch or whatever, flying elbow for flying elbow, however my analogy is going to go here. It's exciting. I don't even know. I just started it and tried to finish it as best I could. This is great. I don't think we could ask for anything more. We have really good Champions League matchups on Tuesday as well coming up. So this soccer run-in is fantastic. Who needs American football? We have soccer.
No, that is true. I mean, we do need American football come the fall, but we certainly do not right now. It does not get much better than this. 8 match days left, and every one of them going to be a cliffhanger. And so we're going to throw away study abroad for today. There wasn't a lot of great action. Like, I don't really want to talk about Lazio Roma, which is not even going to be good on the pitch, and is even uglier off the pitch given some of the recent news. So we are going to do all 5 of the Premier League games or Premier League games that involve Big Six teams, because all of them have very interesting storylines and I think some interesting gambling lines attached. But Brett, before that, I wanted to discuss something that came out on ESPN. I mean, we are distributed by ESPN. They are great partners of ours. And they put out one of their annual articles that I think is one of the most interesting things published every year. And it is the list of under 21 players in world soccer. And so they've been doing this for 5 years straight. And I asked you to look at the list so that we can react to it a little bit. But I think I want to ask you a question a little bit differently than just like, oh, who should have been number one? Because Jude Bellingham should have been number two. Cole Palmer should have been number one. We can agree to that and then just move forward. We don't even need to discuss it. But what I want to talk about is like the Premier League players themselves on the list and players who might end up in the Premier League. And so looking at the Big Six teams, looking at the prospects on the list, I kind of want to talk a little bit about the names on here, and then maybe just for 1 second look back at the list 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and see how predictive this is of the best players on the best teams in the best league in the world. So if you start from the very top, there's not a Premier League player in the top 7. Did that surprise you? Did it surprise you that with all the money in the de facto Super League, that the best youth prospects, the 7 best youth prospects in the world, ply their trade somewhere else?
Not really, kind of with the state of global soccer. Just because of the fact that the Premier League has so much money now, they don't have to be thrifty with their spending. Teams like Brighton and Brentford, that we talk about all the time, or pretty much anyone else, you know, they have to take some gambles on under 21 teenage talent, right? To try to land a superstar. Because that's the only way, other than an academy kid coming through, that they're going to land a superstar. The Premier League, the rest of the Premier League, especially the big clubs, the clubs that we cover week in and week out, they're so rich now, they can just kind of outsource that development and make sure that whoever they buy is a star. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they can just wait and be like, okay, this kid was really good at 20 and really good at 21. We can just spend 80 million because we have 80 million on him, and then we'll get him. And we know that he's got, you know, 2-3 good seasons already of superstar level production. He's played in the Champions League, whatever it may be. So it's sort of like to the point where every other league is the Premier League's farm system.
But do you think that can continue? If FFP is actually going to have a little bit of teeth and there's going to be point reductions and things like that, like, can that continue? Or will there have to be at some point some reversion back to the historical nature of the youth academy and homegrown products and things like that? Because like almost every one of these top seven players that aren't in the Premier League right now have 100 million plus price tags applied to them. And there's not, I mean, I know, yes, United can spend $100 million. City can spend $100 million. But you do it twice, you do it three times, all of a sudden, like, you've got to cook the books pretty hard in order to make up for it. So do you think that, like, this outsourcing will continue indefinitely? Or do you think what we're seeing at Everton, what we're seeing at Forest, what we might be seeing at Chelsea and City might revert that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, I still think that the most efficient purchase is buying future potential production and paying low and getting a kid that's 17 or 18 at 30 million instead of waiting until he's an actualized star and paying 120 for him. I feel like as teams get smarter, they'll take more shots like that. But the thing that might stop it and might be related is because the Premier League is so competitive, because all the matches are so lucrative now, staying up is important, getting to the Champions League is important. A part of the reason I think the list is lacking of Premier League stars is this isn't like a league anymore where you can just get away with playing young guys that might be good someday. You have to win now. So that means you're playing guys that are already in their soccer primes. You're not waiting for a 19-year-old to develop, because you're either on one end of the table or the other. You're trying to avoid relegation, or you're trying to move into the Champions League. And because most of the two parts of the Premier League are doing that, you're kind of just getting this thing where managers are hesitant to play young guys they don't trust.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the list 5 years ago, Brett, it surprised me to see this. There is only one guy on the list 5 years ago who wasn't already at a Premier League club, like Trent Alexander-Arnold, who actually played in the Premier League this past weekend. And it's Kai Havertz. Havertz is the only player who wasn't already in the league, who moved into the league. And now we're talking about a five-year gap, right? So now we're talking about prospects that are in their prime. And so it's kind of interesting that the very best players in the world who come in as youth products from either South America or from, let's just say La Masia, because that's basically what it is, La Masia, like that youth academy, they're staying out of the Premier League. And so I don't know what that really says. Maybe it means something, maybe it means nothing. Like in my brain, it means that, like, basically, the business model of Real Madrid and Barcelona and PSG is superstars. And so these guys that are 18, 19, 20, that are world beaters, the Mbappes of the world, either, you know, come up through La Masia or get bought by them from South America, like an Endrick situation. And like they think about that brand as the brand where superstars play. Whereas the Premier League, I think about it as the brand where the very best teams play, not the very best individual. Maybe it's Ronaldo, maybe it's Messi, maybe it's the fact that they really like became the global superstars they became at Barcelona, at Real Madrid, at PSG, like out of the Premier League, that causes that brand identity. But I think that there is some conflation between like the very top of the superstar echelon and like the very best teams and the leagues they associate with.
Yeah, and I think that's important. And I mean, we're talking a lot about stuff that's, you know, happening on the pitch and where the teams are and how the leagues are structured. And we're forgetting one other key thing that I think drives some of this too is soccer agents, which are absurd in this sport. And there is, I mean, we saw with Erling Haaland, right? Like, there was probably not a reason that he could have went, you know, when he was with the Red Bull system, immediately to a Premier League club from there, right? Like, there was no reason why he couldn't have went from Salzburg to the Premier League. But what happens is the agent can make extra money if he gets sold not once, but twice, right? Yeah. And he's probably going to move again to Madrid at some point in his career, and the agent's going to make more money. So, like, I think with these young players, it's a twofold thing. Agents want to make sure that they're going to send him initially in those prime years, because it kind of is what happened with Martin Odegaard, right? Like, Madrid buy him, he was like 15 or 16, but he had to be loaned out for like ever before he, I mean, he was at Sociedad for a few years and then still never made it at Madrid and had to go to Arsenal, but he basically cut his teeth getting loaned out. And I think instead of trusting a parent club to loan their player out, it's probably just better to send him to a team that's competing for a Champions League spot in a lesser league to ensure that he gets minutes to play. And then the agent also gets the added boost of then when he moves on from that team, from, you know, wherever he comes from, South America or one of the, you know, maybe lesser leagues in Europe, then he gets, when he gets moved on for the big, huge transfer fee, it's just an added bonus, right? So
it's a great point about agents and the way they manipulate this. And it does seem like City is very willing to deal in that muck and mire, which is perhaps why their books are going to come under question eventually. Like the idea that that Haaland moved for like, what was it, 60 million was the official posted fee. Like it was like 250 million when everything was like settled and came out of the dark and into the light. Like it's pretty crazy what happens under the table or under the books. But I guess like, these young boys get so much attention, right? Like it just becomes like a fascination of everybody, the shiny new object, the shiny new thing, projecting potential upon them. We see it in American sports. We see it in soccer. We see it in soccer even worse because it usually starts at like 15 or 16, like for everyone, not just for like crazy people with rival subscriptions here in America. not that everybody who has a rival subscription is crazy, but I think you take my point. It's not the majority of mainstream, where it's far more mainstream in footy. But like, will these guys actually be the most impactful players on their team in their prime? And so like the let me just go through the teams. United, the highest guy on here is Hoyland. Hoyland is number 8 on the list, the highest person in the Premier League, according to ESPN. In 5 years, will Hoyland be the best player on United? I say no.
He's 21. These were minutes he was supposed to be getting at another club. In my opinion, United jumped the gun. I mean, he was a pretty raw player when he came over from Serie A. So I wouldn't put it past him. I would say the odds are low he's their best player in 5 years. But we also kind of have to give him a little bit of credit for the fact that he skipped a huge step, basically.
It's true he did. Like the United pedigree also makes me nervous, right? Like the past 4 years on this list, I'm pretty sure the number 2 guy all 4 years was Jadon Sancho. And so like Jadon Sancho, like they took the number 2 prospect in the world and completely botched him and ruined him. So like Hoyland skipped a step into the wrong place. And I can't believe he's the top rated guy on this list, because the next guy will be the best player on Chelsea, I think, in 5 years. And he should be higher on this list, and it's Cole Palmer. Cole Palmer, I know, like before today, was having an amazing season. After today, he is a god. He is a hero in blue. And we'll talk about him more when we get to Chelsea. But he now has 16 goals. He has 8 assists. He has more goal contributions than Haaland. He's only 2 goals behind him, and he has more assists. Like, he has more goal contributions than the number 1 scoring threat in the world as a 21-year-old, and he's 11th on the list. Get the hell out of here. And unless Enzo, like, truly steps up, or, like, Tevez, or, like, one of these wonder boys, like, exceeds all expectations, Palmer is the future of the squad in 5 years.
Yeah, I think he gets knocked a little bit for Chelsea's team success. I feel like if they were better, if they were even competing for 5th or 6th and weren't so far down the table, I think that would have affected.
Spoiler alert, they're competing for 6th.
They are after today. Yeah. Yes, they are. Yeah. Like that. Yeah, they are. But, you know, obviously the position in the table, how many teams were in front of them leading into today when the article came out and all that stuff, you know, they were – it's a broken season for them. I mean, I don't want to bring up Burnley, but you saw what happened that last week. And so I do think Palmer got dinged a little bit for that. I feel like if Chelsea was better, Palmer would be higher on the list. But this definitely has shades of like the reverse that happened, where Chelsea sold Kevin De Bruyne and then he became Kevin De Bruyne. And then City is selling Cole Palmer and he might become a player like Kevin De Bruyne. Now the overall goal contributions are obviously padded. as he takes the penalties. But he is a very good young player, and he's 21 years old. He's getting a ton of minutes. He's contributing to goal. He's scoring and assisting. So even if you take away the added boost of penalties, which you have to make, by the way, like it's,
yeah,
we talk about penalties as like gifts, like penalties, you have to be converted.
Haaland takes penalties for City, and who brings up his padded goal totals is like, he bangs in goals. And like Palmer, the mentality of Palmer to step up and make both penalties today, to make that big penalty against City, to always want the ball unless Raheem Sterling like somehow shames him out of it. Like he converts it every time. And that Panenka last week against Burnley was absolutely insane and shows like the full master of the craft that this guy has. And so I know that they are inflated because of that, but he's also like unbelievable at it. So we're talking about City. Doku is 13. I don't think Haaland's going to be on City in 5 years. I think Pep's going to be gone, and I think Haaland's going to be either Barcelona or Real Madrid. Do you think Doku has a shot to be the best player on City in 5 years? I don't, because it'll either be Phil Foden or it'll be Jude Bellingham. I mean, I don't think it'll be
Doku. Or Wirtz from Leverkusen. Yeah. Like, there's, I mean, the best player on City in 5 years is probably playing for another team in another league right now. So,
yeah,
I mean, Doku's got a chance. I sort of question where his goal scoring actually will get to. I think he's really good at the Grealish type things of getting into the box and firing passes into the box and being in dangerous areas. It's not like he's going to turn into like Sadio Mane or Mo Salah or any of those guys, I think, as far as goal scoring, which makes me hesitant to say he'll be City's best player in 5 years, because they will get a player that does that really well if Haaland leaves. But I mean, he's good. He's intriguing, but he's also kind of to the point that we've been talking about with this whole thing. Like, that is the bare minimum type of young player that can go to a City and play right now. Like, this is why we don't see 21-year-olds, you know, that are on this list in the Premier League. Like, Doku is basically the lowest you can probably go to buy a young player, and he's still going to play for Pep's squad. So
yeah,
he's an interesting guy to bring up for that.
Well, to your point, Liverpool or Arsenal don't have high people on this list either. But before them is an interesting one. Spurs is Adoji at 21. Is Adoji going to be the centerpiece of the Spurs team once Son moves on?
No, he's not. I mean, I think he's a decent left back. He does some interesting stuff. I don't really see the final third. Like, he's not like a Jordi Alba type of guy. And that typically to be the best player on a really good, on a fairly good team as a fullback, like, you have to be really, really good in the final third. Like, you have to be a guy that is contributing to goals in some way, shape, or form.
But I think it is a little bit worrisome for Spurs that he's the top guy they have on this list. And I don't know, they're not overly great in the transfer market. And like Son and Madison aren't going to be around in 5 years. I mean, Van der Ven is probably going to be their most important player in 5 years that I can see, because I think that he's going to continue to grow into the league. And his speed for the style that Spurs tend to play with all this open space is really important to them. So I think he's got the best shot, but I as usual, I'd be nervous if I was a Spurs fan.
Well, and I also think Spurs are going to be a team in a constant position of like, they will always probably be the front runner for a James Madison type player, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the guy that you're not sure if he's going to raise the ceiling of a true Champions League title contending team, but he's pretty good. They're going to constantly be buying that guy from like, you know, clubs lower down in the Premier League.
Well, Harry Kane might also go full Andrea Pirlo, like 5 years, come back and like run the world and be and be their best player.
Yeah, believe me, I have made jokes about that on Twitter over the years where they have had no midfield. I was like, I think they should just play him as a six.
Liverpool, Connor Bradley, 32. I mean, TAA is going to be better than him, so I don't think he's going to be the best player 5 years from now. But I think they're an interesting case for exactly what you're talking about. Like, Connor Bradley came through the system. He's only on this list because TAA was injured. Like, nobody really even – he wasn't on anybody's radar of, like, best young players in the world 6 weeks ago. And all of a sudden, you know, he's debuting on this list. He's not just debuting. He's the highest guy that got.
Yeah, and then the weird part about that is I think it's Ben Doak, if I remember. I can't believe I'm recalling this from the top of my head. But Ben Doak was like Liverpool's hot prospect coming into this year. So then Connor Bradley came out of nowhere. And within like two or three matches, people are like, oh, yeah, this kid's like pretty good.
And then Arsenal has no one on the list. So Sokka was 3 last year. He just aged out of the list because he's 22 now. So I think Sokka and Rice and that are going to form the spine for 5 years. So like, well, I guess what it is interesting is the so-called also-rans of the Big Six, like the lower three of the trailing the top tier right now, do have players on this list. The best guys, you know, kind of are down except for City with Doku at 13. And I think it's exactly what you're describing. There is space for youth at teams that are trailing the ones that are just going for the title race right now.
Yeah, and I mean, let's face it. The three best teams in the Premier League are also probably contenders for the three best teams in the world. So how many 19-year-olds are breaking into the three best sides in the world? Like, it's just not happening.
Except for, unless your name is Jude freaking Bellingham.
Yeah, the exception that proves the rule kind of deal. Yeah.
Yeah, who's not only maybe the best player on Real Madrid, maybe going to be a Ballon d'Or winner at the age of 20. And is number one on this list. Do you have any other reaction to the list? Because I know we do study abroad. So any other interesting names that you want to discuss before?
No, not really. I think I had kind of the same reactions. It's like whenever I look at prospect lists, like, back in the day when I do fantasy baseball stuff a long time ago, I'm sure you do the same thing. And you're like, I got to get the top 50 prospects because these guys are all going to be stars. And then 5 years later, you like run across those notes or that list and you're like, yeah, like five of these dudes like turned out to be like okay major league players. So that's kind of my reaction to these lists.
They seem to do better in soccer. Just I don't know if it's like the amount of tape they have on these from the time they're like 8 because they're coming up through the system. But just for context, the top 10 5 years ago was Luka Jovic, and then Rashford, Donnarumma, De Jong, Vinny Jr., Kai Havertz, PAA, Delight, Sancho, and Mbappe. Sancho's really the only miss.
Well, I have questions about Delict, but other than that, I get your point. Like, yeah, a lot of these guys pan out and they play. And I think part of the reason that's different is like in a sport like baseball, where I made the joke, you have to at some point be able to like hit a major league curveball, right? And it doesn't matter how many at bats that you get in, like there's just a skill that you have one way or the other where you hit a major league curveball. You know, you can get a little bit better probably with a bunch of at bats. But like the big thing about soccer, and this has been proven, and our friend Ryan O'Hanlon has written about this, and other smart people have talked about this, is young players that just get minutes, even if they're not good, but they just play a lot when they're young, just tend to be pretty good players at some point because they play a ton. And a lot of the sport of soccer is what, like spatial awareness and operating as part of a group of 11 and developing skills that sometimes don't even need you to have the ball, and you bring value to a club by doing that. And the way that you develop those skills is you play a lot. So I think that's part of the reason why maybe the miss rate is a little bit lower in some of these lists for this sport.
Yep. Great point. My only other reactions was I cannot believe Kamavinga is still on this list. Like it feels like he's like 28, but somehow he's still only 21. And like God, Chelsea letting Musiala go and keeping Adoy was just an all-time mistake. So
just focus on Cole Palmer. Get those forced adult adoption papers ready. Just
number 11 on this list, number one in my heart, and he should be number. All right, Wirtz is pretty damn good, but Cole Palmer should be top 5.
Well, I am a huge Wirtz fan. That's my guy, my favorite guy. I mean, Jude is incredible. I don't even really count him as like a under 21. Like he's just he's a global superstar already. Like he just seems like he's been around forever, and it's hard. Like every time I see his age, without fail, I just get shocked. It's like cold water gets thrown in my face, and I'm like, oh my God, like how was he on an under 21 list?
Well, Mbappe was number one on this list for a while, then it was Haaland, and now it's Bellingham. So
yeah,
you know, like when the chosen ones come, they sit here at the top, even though they are incredibly young and still already the best in the world. All right. Well, let's see if we could be the best in the world this week. Brett, let's give Caesars a little bit of love, come back and do our games.
You know, when the conversation turns tampers, I always go with my number one as Caesars. Let's talk about them a little bit, shall we? Tickets to the game, merch, meals at iconic restaurants, stays at Caesars Palace. All this can be yours when you bet with Caesars Sportsbook. Win or lose, every bet earns rewards credits, which you can redeem across the empire. Now, if you haven't started yet, register using this code. Listen up, OmahaFull. The word Omaha and the word full. And then you place your first bet up to $1,250. If you win, great. If you keep those winnings, but if you lose, you'll get your stake back as a bonus bet. 21 and over only. Offer valid and must be physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wyoming. New users and first $10 plus wager only. Must register with eligible promo code. Bet amount of qualifying wager returned only if wager is settled as a loss. Maximum bonus bet, $1,250. Bonus bet expires 14 days after receipt. Tier credits and reward credits will be added to account within 7 days after qualifying wager settles. See Caesars.com/promos for full terms. Void where prohibited. Know when to stop before you start. Gambling problem? Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas, affiliated with Kansas Crossing Casino, call 1-800-522-4700. Indiana, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Iowa, call 1-800-BETS-OFF. Louisiana, call 1-877-770-STOP. Licensed through Horseshoe, Bossier City, and Harrah's, New Orleans. Massachusetts, call 1-800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org. Michigan, call 1-800-270-7117. Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, affiliated with Harrah's, Philadelphia. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER or West Virginia, 1-800-GAMBLER.net. New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac, weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
All right, Brett, we are back, and we have one clash this week between the Big Six that also is going to factor heavily in this exciting title race. And it is Manchester United, sixth at 48 points, versus Liverpool, first, top of the table, baby, 70 points, Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Liverpool is minus 145, United is plus 340, the draw is plus 320. Caesars has Liverpool minus half a goal at that same minus 145, United on the double chance at plus 115. And I know Liverpool is the more important team in this matchup, but Manchester United, dude, you know it's bad. A Chelsea fan feels so horrible for another fan base. First, they had to watch that Brentford game, which was a war crime of a visual matchup. It was the same jersey, just different color stripes on both sides. Like, I don't know why they wore the alts. It was so freaking horrible. It was like watching a kid's rec game where the kids get to name the team and all the jerseys are the same, but the color choices. I couldn't figure out why the rainbow unicorns versus the purple nurples was on my telly. Like, what the hell was that? And then to make it even worse, they take an undeserved lead, United that is, in extra time, and immediately turn around and concede a last-second equalizer. And then a few days later, they have the Chelsea collapse.
It's hard not to. I'm sorry if there's United fans. Again, I've said this before. I'm actually really glad we're not like a nationally renowned show, because I'd be getting death threats for how much I enjoy the United whatever you want to call this, dumpster fire.
Yeah, you just saw my reaction. So what was your reaction to United today and the week they just had?
I don't even have a reaction. My question is, if you're looking to bet on him, if you're looking to even be worse, if you're looking to give your heart to that squad, do you really want to do that after watching the last two matches? Do you really want to do that after watching extra time in the Chelsea match? Absolutely not. So in this match, it's Liverpool money line all the way. And then obviously the bet to pair with that would be Liverpool to win and both the score, which is +125. Like, this is United games. There's no way you can put money on this team. I'm sorry.
If I was a United fan, I would never be able to get over the still image today. I don't know if you've seen this yet. Of the moment there's like a shot from behind the goal, the moment they all realized that Cole Palmer was about to receive a short corner, like he had just run to that space. I think it was seven guys start pointing at him and each other to figure out who's going to close out. And there's just a still shot of everyone pointing at a wide open Cole Palmer at the death about to freaking finish them. And of course,
like my new screensaver.
You know who was the closest guy and was probably his responsibility. It just couldn't be more delicious. It was Mason Mount.
Mason
Mount at the bridge.
Yeah.
Fake tough guy who blew that assignment and gave up the winner. Oh, injected into my veins. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. You already gave your pick. I'm also going to take Liverpool at -145. I loved watching Liverpool this week. I absolutely loved it. And like, I have been accused of being a Liverpool hater in the past, particularly because of my stance on Trent Alexander-Arnold. But it is hard not to like get excited about the front three when they're going to throw out Diaz and Nunez and Salah. Like, if you have a pulse and you are watching these guys work together, and the way that Diaz like geniusly reads space, and the way that Nunez is just relentless in his agent of chaos thing, and Salah just being one of the best players in the world, both at finishing, particularly coming in from the right and hitting it across the keeper, as well as his playmaking, which has evolved tremendously in the last 5 years. Like, it's awesome to watch. And the one that makes me the angriest is McAllister, though. Like, McAllister, they got for a reasonable fee. He's 100% available. He always plays. And then he comes through at the biggest moments to win them games in the second half. So he did it twice this week with the incredible feed last week to help them win that Brighton game. And then obviously with the Thunder Bastard that he won with today. And so, like, why was he $30 million? Like, I hope an agent got $200 million somewhere, because otherwise it is BS that Liverpool's always the one who gets these quality buys.
I think it's just because Liverpool probably has the most professional front office thing. It's like, I mean, it's like the Cody Gakpo signing. Not saying that it was a great signing, but like, that came out of nowhere. There was nothing reported about Cody Gakpo. And then he got, you know, kind of bought for a reasonable price for like a fourth or fifth attacker. Like, they clearly have a very good approach to the chaos in the soccer world. They know who they're targeting. They reach out to the people that are representing them early. They have negotiations with the agents and then the player. You know, players want to come play for Anfield. Like, there's clearly something in the way that they do business that helps them with these fees, and they don't get dragged into these bidding wars, although they kind of did with Caicedo, and he got saved, I think, from that one. But yeah, I think they just know their targets and they go get them, and then they get them at a good price.
Well, the other thing they do, and as a Chelsea fan, it's the other reason I loved watching them this week that I'm so envious of, they just don't take their foot off the gas. Like, they go up 2-1 and they don't go into a shell just trying not to lose it. They continue to attack relentlessly. And like, yes, maybe it'll burn them every once in a while, but like, you know what also burns you all the time is going into that shell, like all of a sudden not being who you are, not taking the space that's available to you, not taking it to the other team. That also burns you. And so, like, I love the idea that they go up and they just continue to like go after it. And I don't think there is an off switch for Diaz and Nunez. And so, like, there really isn't a way to like harness those guys in. But like, gosh, is it refreshing to watch?
Yeah, during the City Arsenal match, I texted a friend. These two teams are great. This match sucks. And he texted me back, if Liverpool hire a boring manager, I might stop watching the Premier League. And, I mean, but that it's just their style of play. And it's part of the analytics infused approach that they have is more goals in a match always favor the stronger team. And Liverpool play a style that creates maximum chances. And it's why their games against City and their matches against Arsenal, even though they got smacked that one round, but that's why those matches, those heavyweight bouts, always seem to be more fun than these super cagey Arsenal City matches where it's just like, oh my God, it's 60 minutes in. There's like 9 total shots. What's going on here, guys?
So, Brett, you already gave out your prop bet. I am going to do something I haven't done in 3 years. I am doing something brand new. I wanted to mix it up this week. For those of you who are listening to this, hopefully you also listen to Trendy. And you know, one of the categories is the heater, where you just take one thing and you do it over and over and over again. So I picked one prop and I'm doing it in all 5 games. And all 5 of these is my 5 pint. Okay. And so I'm doing the same thing 5 different ways, because I kept looking at these games and I kept coming to the exact same conclusion in all 5. I love the offense and defense of the favorite, and I hate the offense and defense of the underdog. Of all 5 games, all 5 of them.
Yeah, you're the not wrong in this slate. Yeah.
So how can I take advantage of that? I am playing an SGP in every single game of the favorite scoring at least 2 goals and the underdog failing to get 2 goals. And so you look at it, it is the favorite over 1.5, the underdog under 1.5. Doing it in every game, allowing myself for the flukiness that is soccer to creep in. They're allowed to be a 1-goal fluke. But I think every one of these offenses is going to shatter the other team, particularly like a United team that is still employing. Every single week, I feel so bad for the treasurer or the controller or whoever has to look down at their ledger and write a paycheck to Harry Maguire. Every week, some poor bastard has to do this. And every week, they keep putting that guy back out there. I was like, well, why was today 4-3? Like, well, I don't know. Like, you've got a stump playing in the middle of your field and tried to recover into space that Manu and Casemiro keep leaving him out to dry. It. Like, good freaking luck. And good freaking luck doing that against Nunez and Diaz. So they're going to score twice. I mean, like, okay, maybe there's a fluke, one fluke goal against Liverpool, because they do tend to concede one like that. But I'm willing to go into my bag here for plus money that United can't do it twice, and is plus 130 in this game.
I like it. That's a great bet. Yeah. I don't really have anything to say. That's just a good bet. I mean, you've given away the farm on all your prop bets for the rest of the teams, but I mean, it's a great bet. I love this. I mean, my strategy is also similar. I have been terrible since my heater. So I'm just going good team to do a good thing. And you're doing that in just a very fun, unique way.
Yep. All right. Well, let's see if we can do it in another fun, unique way with Crystal Palace 14th at 30 points versus Manchester City third, 67 points. This game is Saturday at 7:30 AM. Manchester City is minus 320. Palace is plus 900. The draw is plus 300. City minus a goal and a half is minus 105. Palace is minus 125. So we spent, I don't know, a good 20 minutes on the match last week. I guess we should spend 2 minutes now. Any takeaways from City and Arsenal?
They're great teams, but I don't want to watch them play each other.
What a freaking dud, dude. What a dud that was.
Yeah, I mean, it's just what happens when you have two teams where their backbone is controlling the ball and defending. And I mean, Arsenal also just like kind of set up shop. Like I think they had like 6 shots throughout the match. The City had like 75% possession. So it was very much like they were trying to get a point out of the match. They weren't really playing to win. They played a lineup that reflected that, and it resulted in a not very exciting match.
God, that was horrible. That was like worse than Illinois-UConn, because at least there was an interesting half in Illinois-UConn. Like there was hardly an interesting moment in that game. I thought that what I walked away with was that I was more impressed with Arsenal. And in being more impressed with Arsenal, it wasn't Arsenal, it was Arteta. Like, Arteta basically dictated exactly what he wanted out of that game, which was a dull, drab affair that resulted in 1 point for each team, and therefore City not making up the ground and putting Arsenal way on the back foot in the title race. And Pep couldn't counter it. So, like, is it a strange coming out party for Arteta as a top tier manager that he was able to force such a horrible game upon all of us?
No, I think it was mostly just like when they play Jorginho at the base and Declan Rice in the midfield and stop trying to win the ball back, Like, that's just what you get. I mean, I think it was very much, it was what I think it actually would be a case almost opposite that, because it was very much Arteta being like, we're really good defensively, and I only want to point out of this match. I think that was the level of thought that went into this.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm giving him too much credit, but like, Pep usually can make some adjustment. Like, City has incredible flair players and so much firepower in that midfield. You think at some point he would go for it. So either he was also comfortable with 1 point, or he just couldn't find a way to counter it. It's probably the former, but if it's the former, that's weird to me. It's weird to me he would be comfortable with 1 point unless he is like not convinced that Liverpool and Arsenal can have a strong run in and his team can.
Well, I think it's just more, you know, do you want to take your shot to possibly, you know, lose the Premier League if you give up 3 points to your opponent in that match? Or would you rather be like, I'm going to take my shot beating up on all the other minnows that we have coming in and hope, you know, one of these matches end in a draw?
Maybe, but when you're third in a three-horse race right now. Like, if he was first, I understand that. But right now, they do not control their own destiny. And even if it comes down to goal differential, Liverpool's ahead on goal differential too. So they're not just down 3 points. They're down 3 points plus GD. Like, you got to go for it at some point, right? Like, Pep doesn't need my advice, but with 8 match days left, you can't just like bank on the future and think that these particular teams are going to fail like Liverpool teams did in the past when it came down to the big matches.
I think it's just more City's season was over if they lose. And we know Pep's penchant. He doesn't want to give up a goal on a counterattack. And so if you're throwing bodies forwards and you're getting extra attacking and they lose to Arsenal, that's ballgame. That's season. So I think there was just so much incentive for both of these teams to just take a point and walk away and then try to just make it up against everybody else that they're clearly better than. That was, to me, was the only thing I took away. It was just, there's just two teams that wanted a point for different reasons. Risk aversion. They're not maniacs like me. They're just like, I don't have the money to do this, but I'll do it anyways.
What I took away from City this week was a bunch of cash on their midseason or their midweek game, because I knew they were going to come out and pound the snot out of that team, being as angry as they were at how dull the game was the weekend before. So more than happy to benefit on that 4-1. And they are playing a team that is low-key garbage to me right now. Like, Palace haven't beat a team not in a relegation position this entire calendar year. They've not beat a team not in relegation position in 2024. And not only that, they have not scored more than a goal versus a team not in relegation position this entire year. This was the first game I looked at before I even looked at Liverpool United. I was like, oh, I am going to make this bet. This bet is a home run. So not only am I taking City on the adjusted at -105, my prop, my usual over 1.5, under 1.5, because City always does seem to leak a goal. That is -150. But just because I want to play the pattern, I'm going to play that in the 5 pint. Personally, I'm going to adjust that up to over 2.5 for City, which gets you all the way to +170.
Yeah, I'm taking City on the adjusted as well. And due to your same logic, City clean sheet win is only -115. I thought that'd be like -150 in this match. I love Abrucciese. I think he's a super fun player to watch. That said, his funness is on one end. If he's your best attacker, I'm not sure that your attack is remotely good. So, yeah. And Olise is out, in fairness to them. Like that, the clubs like that can't afford to miss a player like Olise. But yeah, I thought Glasner might mix it up. He did some interesting stuff at Frankfurt before he came over. He did switch to a back three. Yay, Chris Richard playing for the US. But other than that, it's been pretty brutal. They got good results against Burnley and Luton Town, but I mean, like, who's going to really get excited over that?
Well, they managed to bank enough points back in August in order to avoid the relegation scrap, but we're not betting on games in August. They are going to get rolled this weekend. They're going to get rolled by City.
Yep. And that's why I'm counting on a good team to do a good thing. And 2 5-pint bets are going to be City related for me.
All right. Well, good luck with that, because they always do leak a team to, or leak a goal, no matter how, what quality opponent they are facing. Getting to our third match, we have Brighton, ninth at 43 points versus Arsenal, second at 68 points. Saturday at 12:30 p.m., rounding out the trio of title-contending teams. Here, we're going to get a lot of good action early in the weekend for the title race. Arsenal is minus 165. Brighton is plus 425. Caesars has the draw at plus 300. Arsenal minus 0.5 is minus 170. Brighton is plus 130 to play spoiler here. So before, we've talked a lot about Arsenal in the last game because we talked about the last week's matchup. Where does Brighton finish? Like, does any team between 6 and 12 actually look good? Is it just a bunch of crap?
Well, I mean, we talked about this last week. There's three good teams. There's two really bad teams. Sort of three really bad teams. And then everybody else is like, in the same margin of error, basically. And Brighton falls. I mean, their attackers have all been hurt. You know, Pedro's been out, Matoma's been out, Ferguson's been in and out and hasn't been kind of the ascending Irish superstar that we thought he might be. Even when he's played, Danny Welbeck's eaten a lot of minutes because of that. They played kind of some random young guys. Like, they just can't create chances right now. Their underlying numbers are given everything that's happened, the losses of McAllister, Caicedo, injuries to all their attackers, some players not kind of working out. Their underlying numbers are actually pretty good given their payroll and given the added games of the Europa League. But they just aren't creating chances anymore. Like, this attack, the De Zerbi attack, and part of it's the players, but they're just not creating good chances. They've created maybe a goal's worth of chances in a handful of games out of their last seven, you know, going back to the end of February. You know, so this one to me was like a no-brainer when you're going up against the best defensive team in the world to take Arsenal not only on the money line, but I'm taking that adjusted goal number way down to under 2.5 goals at plus 130, because I don't think Arsenal's, you know, Brighton has tightened up defensively, thankfully, during the stretch, which has sort of kept them afloat. And the Arsenal attack has not looked great in the last couple of matches that they played. Obviously, the Porto stuff I brought up a ton. So the under 2.5 goals seems like it suits you no matter the result. Fluke 1-1 draw, fluke 0-0 draw, 1-0 Brighton win, or 2-0 up to 2-0 Arsenal win seems like it hits. The only one it really doesn't is probably 2-1 Arsenal.
My bet for this game does pay out on a 2-1 final score, and it is plus 110 for Arsenal over 1.5, Brighton under 1.5. The only other thing I wanted to talk about before we move on is the lineup for City. And does it mean anything for Arsenal, for the City matchup? Does it mean anything for Arsenal moving forward? What did you think of Jesus starting on the wing with Havertz in the middle and Martinelli moving to the bench? Like, that, it surprised me to play Jesus on the wing with Havertz leading the line. I don't know if it was just because of the defensive style and they wanted Havertz's energy and tracking back. And then against, you know, a team like Brighton, maybe Jesus moves back up top. But what do you think the lineup's going to look like versus Brighton? Because that probably is going to inform which bets you want to make.
It might change, but Jesus has been slowly gradually worked back into the lineup. Trossard's fitness is weird. Like, they never, like, he never plays a full 90 even when he starts. So they're clearly know something or monitoring something, or their sports physios are telling him something about Trossard not being the guy that you can just throw out there constantly. But I think that is kind of the thing. Like, Jesus's best attribute when he was City, you know, he got derided for all the times he didn't finish chances, but he was an outstanding presser and ball winner for a forward. I mean, he was relentless. And then Havertz, we've talked about him as being the poor man's Firmino, which is exactly one of the skill sets that Firmino had. So I'm curious to see, because, you know, Arteta's done this thing too, to compound that, is Jorginho at the base of the midfield with Rice moving up even further. So you're getting even more defensive in that setup. And that might be what he's trying to do. He's probably just been leaning into the defensive thing. And look, Martinelli hasn't been good. So if you're going to get plus defending and pressing out of Jesus and a guy that can kind of crash the box with this false nine that Havertz plays, I actually like the lineup. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not saying I like Jorginho at the base of a midfield still, especially if you're competing for a title in the Premier League in 2024. But that combination of attackers, I actually do really like.
Well, they might not need it against Brighton, who has not hit two goals in 8 straight games. And so I think both of our bets are good coming up out of there. One more game before we do the break, and I am going to spare everybody Chelsea right now. So I'm going to give you a chance to bail before I revel in today's glory. So let's skip ahead to the Tottenham game, which is fifth at 57 points versus Nottingham Forest, 17th at 25 points. This game is Sunday at 1 p.m. Tottenham is minus 250, Forest is plus 600, the draw is plus 400. The Spurs minus a goal and a half is minus 105, Forest is minus 125. Brett, it still makes me happy to see certain ex-Chelsea players do so well. So watching that Spurs and West Ham matchup last week was super fun. It was a 1-1 draw that came from a Timo-created goal, and then Happy Zuma heading in the equalizer to make it 1-1. It's a reminder of these like great days that I think of fondly at Chelsea. Plus, the end of that game was completely insane. Like, it was nuts the way they went end-to-end back and forth at the very end. It was like exhausted boxers holding each other up in the 15th, and then with the last 10 seconds, they just unload a flurry of knockout punches on both sides trying to end the fight. Like, it was just wild to watch. It felt like West Ham was the better team, and it was the usual Spurs BS that gave them a point. So for me in this match, and I know like this is a typical fade Spurs, I think Spurs will win this match. I think they will qualify for the Champions League. All the good things that I usually say. Minus 250 is too much. Minus 250 is too much, which is an opening for Forest, because like the Spurs, unlike Liverpool, unlike Arsenal, unlike City, you are not shocked when they stub their toe. You are not shocked at all. It is on brand for them to stub their toe. So if you're going to give me 6-1 in any game that doesn't involve Burnley or Sheffield, I have to at least consider it, and I'm going to consider it here.
You literally took the words right out of my mouth. That was my whole point, is other than Sheffield or Burnley, what team do you trust Spurs to beat more than six times out of 10? And, you know, the one thing I will say, Nuno is a pretty uninspiring hire. Forest is like a boring team that just bought in a billion mediocre players. But Nuno's thing is like he can get kind of like mid-table or below teams to defend a little bit. And Forest has been better. They've been better on that end, which has been shocking. They were pretty poor and leaking a lot of goals before he came in. It's been better lately. I think it keeps them close enough where they can steal this, and you're getting so much value on the money line. And then the Wood goal scoring number, like, this isn't going to be a 0-0 match. Like, even if Forest have been better defensively, like, they're not going to win 1-0. Chris Wood as an anytime goal scorer, it's a little high at plus 185, but Wood does get penalty equity. So that helps that value a lot. I would not take that number if it was just him trying to score an open play. And we know that the Spurs leak goals, and he's also a threat on set pieces, unlike some other strikers, because of his size. So there's set piece opportunities for him to score. There's penalty opportunities for him to score and open play stuff. So I kind of like that plus 185 for him.
My bet is the same one, even though I'm saying I would take Forest if I was betting the money line. If you're going to play this SGP and Spurs win 2-1, which is a very Spursy thing to do, more so than 2-0, that's minus 130 for this game. And Forest has been under two goals in 5 of the last 6 and for most of their time in the Premier League. In general, they don't usually hit 2 goals. And so I think that you're getting some decent value there. I'm also very glad to stop talking about this very mid team in Spurs and moving on to a break so I can spare everybody before I absolutely go nuts about the end of today's Chelsea game. So we'll be right back for that.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, Brett, as half the audience heads for the exits, just like they did at Stamford Bridge today, let's see if we can bring them all back with a stirring couple of minutes. We have Sheffield United's 20th at 15 points versus Chelsea, 10th, baby. I've never been more excited to shout the words 10th next to Chelsea, 43 points. Improvement, Sunday at 12:30 p.m. Chelsea is minus 250. Sheffield is plus 600. The draw is plus 400. Chelsea minus a goal and a half is plus 100. Sheffield is minus 130. And holy freaking smokes, what a difference 2 minutes can make. For example, I had to redo my notes for this segment. I had to cross out, give me Sheffield United -9.5 at 1 million to 1, because why not? The Chelsea was the suckiest sucks who ever sucked after blowing that versus Burnley. Why could they not lose 10-0 to Sheffield and I could make $1 million? But all of a sudden, Cole Palmer changes all of that. And forget about me. Poch wasn't going to get out of the parking lot. Half the fans left just to get the best spot possible to rock his car on the way out of there and to put him in danger after they blew that 2-0 lead and after they blew that Burnley match last week. And then suddenly they summon their inner Tottenham Hotspur, their inner Spurs BS. I'll save you the bleep. And thank they pull you. The Spursiest Spurs result out of their rectum and come up with 2 goals to win the match. And now I feel amazing.
I mean, yeah, that was the hopes for European contention right there. Yeah, it was a huge result. Like, this is going to be one where I think we look at the end of the year, and if Chelsea winds up sneaking into one of those Europa spots, it's going to be this match. It's going to be this crazy ending. Like, it looked like it was done and over with and cooked when they lost to or drew against a 10-man Burnley team, which is a loss. But yeah, I mean, I don't trust Chelsea like at all. And you can, I mean, you're on cloud nine, but you still know that you can't trust Chelsea. So for me, the play was the Sheffield plus the goal and a half. But the thing that I do think is going to be interesting is we've seen a bunch of crazy matches from Chelsea this year. We were talking about this a little bit off air. Like, they have played some nuts matches. And I think that's going to give you a lot of
4-4 City match, the Spurs match where they went down to 9 men.
Yeah.
This match. I mean, like, it's not just, it's something I actually want to talk about. It's not just that they play nutty matches. They play nutty matches against the Big Six.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about why that is. And it's because the Big Six aren't afraid of Chelsea. And so, like, when there is space, Chelsea's individual quality shines through so hard because they have the opportunity to do the things that made them $100 million players, that made them like the superstars they've been since 8 years old. Where they struggle is against crap teams that pack it all in and don't let them do what they do. And so, like, they are at their absolute best playing against quality opponents that play like on the front foot, that allows Chelsea to also play on the front foot rather than just like slamming the ball into parked buses over and over again.
Thank you for making my point of why I was going to take the under of 3.5 goals and minus 125, because I feel like these crazy matches against the Big Six are going to inflate any goal total in the Chelsea's favor. And unless you're a huge Ollie McBurnie stan for Sheffield, it's not like Sheffield's going to get more than one. And this Chelsea attack is not good against teams that are going to just give them and concede the ball. Especially we have to be very wary of how Poch is going to set that team up as well. We've talked about Caicedo in those matches and how he operates. So getting minus 125 for under 3.5 goals seems like a steal.
Yeah. Well, I had another question for you before I give my pick. Palmer is clearly now our Lord and Savior. It worries me a little bit that he is definitely looking to shoot first all of a sudden because he, and for good reason, doesn't really trust his teammates to finish. And that's fine for this season, but they really want to contend. Like, if this isn't like, oh, we'll be happy with 10th forever. They actually want to go after titles again, which is what Chelsea does. They're not the Spurs, for God's sakes. If they want to do that, like the saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together, starts to kick in. So everybody else needs to raise their game. But Palmer went from like looking to pass first in these situations to firing off shot after shot after shot. Like, watch the first 20 minutes of Burnley again, now that I told you that. And it's wild how he doesn't look left and right and just stare straight to the center. And so, like, I think that that will adjust back to the norm because his passing is actually his best attribute more than his finishing. We compared him to KDB earlier, and like, God willing, that's where he'll end up. But I think that's one thing. But besides that point, the question I have for you, Brett, you study tactics more than I do. You're on Twitter tactics and Reddit tactics, and you got your boards and you got all those things. Is Chelsea playing 4D chess right now, or are they eating the chessboard? Because it seems to be their best offensive attack is absolutely throw it out to a tricky winger who's really good at dribbling and is really fast, and have him beat the guy into the box and get taken down from behind. And then they have an incredible penalty taker. So, like, in the era of VAR, which now gets to review all of the contact in the box and seems to me, without looking at any numbers, seems to me to be more likely to reward a penalty than things were in the past, because there's a little bit more of, like, letter of the law applied under video review. Is this idea not that crazy? Just, like, throw it out to Madueke, or throw it out to Mudryk, let them beat their guy, let them try to, like, catch him, take him down from behind, and let Palmer score 100 goals.
Well, I mean, I think the idea of setting up, well, first off, I'm going to rewind to one point. If I'm ever a part of Soccer Tactics Twitter, it's me trying to take it down from the inside, like Ron Swanson in the government. but for this question, there's always been a goal for teams to get one-on-ones with their wingers to dribble into the box. It's kind of how it's why Pep wants guys like Grealish and Doku, is like he wants to stretch things out and have five attackers.
But those guys actually have the ability to cut the ball back. My guys just have the ability to fall down very dramatically at the first point of contact. So,
well, I mean, it's not a bad thing. I mean, look, part of the reason why good teams are good is they have the ball in the penalty area more. And if you have the ball in the penalty area more, random stuff happens. Deflected goals. Guys getting taken down when they dribble into the box. Like, so I think that's the idea. And I mean, it's part of the reason why, you know, you want to have these players that can do that. Because, I mean, the other part of it too is, like, they don't have any real good ways outside of Cole Palmer to get the ball into the box as is, especially with Reece James out. Like, they don't have a guy that plays that pass into the final third of those combinations.
Well, they also don't have a guy to receive the pass. So they have no one to pass it, and they have no one to pass it to. So let's just fall over in the area.
Yeah, so I think it does. That's kind of the poor man's way to manufacture chaos in the box, is just get a dribbly winger, like a Wilfred Zaha type, who doesn't have a great end product, and let him dribble into the box and just shrug and be like, all right, we'll see what happens now. So right now it's leading to penalties and stuff. But I mean, penalties are so hard to predict. I don't think it's an actual 4D chess strategy. I also don't think Poch is the kind of guy that operates at that level. So
what if the whole team was made out of Zaha? That is what we were exploring right now. It's right super there, fun.
That's episode title. There we go.
So I know after all this euphoria, you would expect me to take Chelsea on the adjusted, but I have also watched Chelsea this year, and I know I'm not allowed to have nice things. So maybe, again, I'm doing something I rarely ever do. Give me the draw. Draw plus 400 is my bet this way. It's not the coward's way out. I actually think the coward's way out here is taking the better team to blow out the relegation-bound Sheffield team. I'm taking the courageous thing and saying that Chelsea will blow it yet again by finding a way to snatch the victory out of the jaws of defeat, or however that phrase is supposed to go. So I'm taking the draw, 400, best value on the board, but I am playing my bet, Chelsea to score twice, giving up a usual goal for no reason. Maybe Casado just passes it. It cuts out the middleman, passes it directly into the net this time, is more efficient. And that's the way that Sheffield gets their one. It's minus 125 for that.
Well, I like it. I'm still reeling from the fact that you came up with the episode title this time. So, and it's easily the best episode title we've ever had. So I'm not even close. It's like when Michael Schur talks about Parks and Rec, and he talks about how the best thing that was ever in the show was Chris Pratt's improvised line of, Leslie, I typed your symptoms in the computer and it says you have network connectivity issues. And Schur's like, I've always hated him that he came up with the best line in the show.
Well, I'll tell you what was not the best line of this show. It was whatever you gave out in the five pint last month. Because holy smoke.
La, 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 la. This is an
episode. The episode title should actually be, is Be Like December Brett, Not March Brett. Because you were so bad last month and I delivered an epic beatdown on you. It would be rude to tell everybody how big it was, but it was 16.5 to 3.5.
Oh, God.
So let's see if you can do a little bit better. Everybody already has mine, but just to recap, I am taking favorites over 1.5, underdogs under 1.5 for a pint in all five games. Liverpool's plus 115, Chelsea's minus 125, Spurs is minus 130, City is minus 150, Arsenal is plus 110. And if you really want to get jiggy with it, put all 10 of those together for plus 2,300. Let's do go.
Do it like that one dude who bet all those like random underdog things happening. Get on it. For my five pint, I'm trying to take it back and keep things simple. All right. So it's good teams to do good things. So I got City minus 1.5 at minus 105. I got a City clean sheet win. I got the under of 2.5 goals in Arsenal. I have Liverpool to win in both the score. And then I have the under of 3.5 goals in Chelsea, Sheffield, which that one actually doesn't count as a good team. It's more like mediocre teams to suck and not score. But
yeah,
majority, 4 out of 5 are good teams doing good things.
There you go. All right, well, we will be back hopefully doing some good things next week as we get deeper into this title race and also seeing what the heck the Champions League deals us midweek. So that's going to be super fun. And oh, wait, you're on Trending next week, right?
Yeah, I am. Masters time, baby. And so, Champions League. I get Champions League and Masters in the same week. Let's go.
And the NCAA Championship games. It's almost like we planned this, Brett.
Weird. It's like we had like a thought ahead of what people would be good on what week.
So professionalism. You don't have to wait until Thursday next week. Check out Trendy. We will be covering the Champions League on the Monday.
Tuesday Monday games episode. Are going to be awesome.
It's going to be awesome. Until that time, join us on Trendy. Enjoy the title race this week and every week from now until the end of the season. We'll be back to talk about it next week with our usual interchange of horrible advice backed by expert analysis. Take care, everyone.